you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me once again is the biggest Tarzan fan that I know, and that's a good thing, because we're here to talk about Limited Collector's Edition number C-22, Tarzan of the Apes, and former guest of the show, Brian Heiler. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Rob. Happy to be here.
I'm so glad to have you here. Of course, you did our G.I. Joe show. Now we're way on the other side of the pop culture spectrum, I would say, to talk about.
And aren't we time-wise kind of like at the start of Treasury Editions here? Like, this is G.I. Joe's sort of towards the end.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. It's kind of funny. I mean, I was going to get into that, of like how prevalent Tarzan was in terms of when DC got the property, how it went all in. This is basically DC's third ever Treasury. They started them with Rudolph, and then they did Shazam, and then Tarzan. So Tarzan got a Treasury edition before Superman, before Batman. You know, like, that's how big Tarzan was to DC at the time.
It's funny, the first three Treasury editions by DC weren't DC properties.
That's right.
Isn't that interesting?
I didn't even think about that. Yeah. You're right. They were all additions. Isn't that amazing? This book is we've talked about this on previous episodes of Treasury Cast about how sometimes these Treasury comics were basically trade paperbacks before there were trade paperbacks.
Yeah.
Where they would collect either one story spread across a bunch of comics, or at the very least like a theme. Well, this is the former, because this book reprints Tarzan numbers 207 through 210, which is the origin of Tarzan of the Apes. Now, I would say, along with Superman's origin and Batman's origin and maybe Spider-Man's, like, even people that have never seen a Tarzan movie or know much about Tarzan, they know Tarzan's origin. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree, but with the ibid that their perception of Tarzan, I think, is often wrong. And I say that because when I read this as a kid, I was shocked to discover that Tarzan was literate.
Right.
Because, you know, you grew up with – I'm sure you're the same way. You could watch a Tarzan movie every Saturday, flicking channels.
Oh, yeah.
And it was mostly Wise Miller or Buster Crabbe or you know, Gordon Scott. And they kind of played Tarzan as kind of a dope, you know? I mean, me, Tarzan, you, Jane. Is,
right, the monosyllabic.
Yeah, big metal bird in sky. And that really actually isn't Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan. He's kind of smart. Mm-hmm. And I've always kind of been grateful to this comic for turning me on to that world.
Yeah, I mean, DC really, obviously, was really big into Tarzan. Now, Tarzan, of course, debuted in what? I think 1915? Is that right?
Yeah, I know I'm the biggest Tarzan fan you know, but I know much, much bigger, smarter fans will be yelling at this episode.
Okay.
and I take my lumps. But yes, I mean, I believe Burroughs sold it as a story to a magazine.
Right.
And I believe this story is actually the only one in public domain. Or one of
the few.
Oh,
interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So you and I could put out our own Tarzan comic of this, but there's things
we'll have to have a conversation later.
I can't draw a lick, so.
But when DC bought the – I mean, first of all, Tarzan comics started in 1948, and they were published by Dell. And they ran into the 50s, and then the license was taken over by Gold Key, although, of course, the Dell-Gold Key relationship very intertwined.
Yeah, I think actually Gold Key just kind of had it the entire time, right?
Right. It was labeled Dell. I've never been able to fully understand that relationship, but they basically published Tarzan comics continuously all the way up into the 1970s, and then DC took over in 1972, and they continued the numbering.
Yeah.
So the same book just went on. I mean, the first DC Tarzan book is like number 205 or 206. And it's just, I think they even had the blurb, first DC issue, back when, you know, you kept the numbering, I guess, with those pesky postal regulations. They wanted to keep the numbering going.
And, you know, it isn't quite the coup, like, you know, Marvel got Star Trek away from Gold Key. And, you know, the Gold Key Star Trek comics were a bit janky. They did a really nice job with Tarzan. For the most part.
Yeah, I mean, they put Joe Kubert on it. My former instructor, as everybody knows, he wrote and drew this adaptation.
Oh, yeah. No, what I meant was Gold Key actually was doing a pretty good job with Tarzan.
Oh, I see. Oh,
right,
of course.
They had beautiful art and nice stories. And I have some of those comics, and they're really – they're not embarrassing. They did a nice job with Tarzan. But, yes, for DC, of course, still went all out and got Joe Kubert.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, they published a Tarzan Digest, which was DC's first digest. They'd never done it, and it was the only one they did for about five or six years.
Stories.
Right, it's just reprinting Gold Key stories with a Joe Kubert cover. Very strange beast to have this one-off digest.
It's almost like a proof of concept, or they just needed to get something out there. I have that digest. I'm a digest guy, too. That one always kind of makes me scratch my head a little bit as to what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I wonder, like, they put this out and then never did another one for 7 years. They're like, okay, they have a digest. But so, I mean, they started publishing Tarzan of the Apes, and then very quickly, less than a year later, here he gets his own treasury. Again, it reprints the first four issues. And within a couple of years, they would have a Tarzan family comic, which was, again, taken over from the Gold Key. So they were big on Tarzan. And Joe Kubert, at this point in his career, he, of course, still did lots of artwork. He was still drawing Sergeant Rock occasionally and doing lots of covers. But he was, at that point, he had been doing comics for 30 years already.
Yeah.
He was transitioning out of being a regular artist and being more of an editor, but clearly he loved Tarzan.
He took
all this himself.
This is a labor of love, and I think it's something I could be wrong because it's buried in my head, but I think it's something he lobbied for at DC.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was his pet project. I mean, he used to, back when we had him in school, he would talk about Tarzan, how much he loved Tarzan, the original comic strip. And so it was something that clearly still stirred him as an artist to, like, you know, I want to just do Tarzan. And so he went full out and adapted the original novel, Tarzan and the Apes himself, and drew it all.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody really is unfamiliar with the origin. So this book, other than the special features, which we'll get to, is just one story. It's the entire origin of Tarzan, broken up into chapters. And, I mean, Joe Kubert's artwork, I'm a huge fan of it. I always was. I was a fan ever before I ever went to his school, and luckily it worked out that I didn't have to pretend to be a fan of his work. But, I mean, from the cover, this beautiful cover with this azure blue background of Tarzan fighting an ape, it's just a beautiful presentation. I mean, are you a fan of Joe's work?
I'm such a fan of Joe's work that I've done odd things. Case in point, remember like in 94, G.I. Joe switched to this thing called Sergeant Savage, which was kind of like a Doc Savage ripoff, and it had Kubert artwork. I was in college. I had like no money, and I had like all of those figures. And I remember like, what am I doing? And it was just that. Like the presentation, like, and again, I didn't even like G.I. Joe, like the real, like that wasn't my thing, but it was that Joe Kubert artwork on the packaging. It kind of connected to Doc Savage, and and I own a whole bunch of Sergeant Rock merchandise, and it's like, I don't even know how many, like, I've probably read like four Sergeant Rock comics, but it's that drawing of Sergeant Rock on the card and the figure. Like, it's just so cool. It's a lot like, Super 7 does a lot of really cool cards with figures now, you know, Monsters and Lords of Light, Kirby. And again, that's sort of the same appeal. So, yeah, I'm a huge Joe Kubert fan.
Yeah, and I mean, I love seeing his stuff at this big size. I mean, the work here is just brilliant. And we'll have some pages on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. But, like, page 7, where you've got the Claytons discovering, seeing the ape in the shadows, and, like, the wife is like, what was it? And she looks scared, and it's all done in a blue light.
Oh, yeah.
And the pages of the when the ape attacks Tarzan's eventual mother and Alice. I mean, like, there's just every page here is just beautifully rendered by Joe. It's a really great telling of this classic story.
Yeah, I would liken it, like, you know, Kirby got to do 2001,
right,
which he clearly was a huge fan of. And the love kind of comes out of that. And this sort of has that same feel to me where he really, you know, he's so engaged that he's thought of every scene here. And he's done a really nice job with the storytelling.
Yeah, he picks certain moments I like to – I mean, it's mostly narrated as if like it was in the book.
Yeah.
But then there's moments where he just drops all the narration and all the dialogue, and there's just some silent panels.
Yeah, page 13 is epic where, you know, John's dad – Tarzan's dad's about to die. And that closing, you know, closing panel of just him staring at the apes at the door is beautiful.
Yeah, you know? It's really, really nice. Yeah. And then later on, there's a sequence where Tarzan and the ape and his friend are at the watering hole, and the tiger is about to get the drop on them. There's that. It's really nice. And then there's another one later on where he's fighting up in the trees, and one of the apes gets pitched out of the branch and falls to its death. I mean, it's just he really clearly loved every second of this thing, and it's just. And then there's the scene later on where he's fighting the tribesmen.
Yeah.
And there's three panels, and there's not even any color in the background. It's just these two figures fighting from a distance. And, you know, I mean, I think a lot of other artists, if they tried to do that, it would look like a cheat.
Yeah.
But this just looks – I know this looks like it's just a perfect visual choice of just – we're focusing on the action here. And again, it's just really – sumptuously.
And I want to say is kudos for how much covering of nudity he does.
Yes.
You know, because Tarzan is naked for the first bunch of the story. And he's. Do you ever watch like old Benny Hills where he's naked and everything, like the mailbox gets in the way? And, you know, it kind of reminds me of that, but it's much more clever the way he's done it here, you know.
Tarzan's thigh is always covering up his private parts or whatever, or the shadows are draping or whatever.
It totally reminds me of my doctor's office when I was a kid. He had like the child's Bible. And the drawings of Adam were ludicrous because Adam would just be standing in a field, but thankfully there was a sunflower. it reminds me of that. They could have taken some notes from Kubert on how to do it with it, where it's much more subtle.
Yeah, it's not comical. I mean, they're telling a very dramatic story. Now, the first chapter and the second chapter are split up by a pinup, a really just straight-ahead classic pinup.
Oh, yeah.
Of him doing the thing.
Like, who would steal that, though? Like, who would rip that out and put that on their wall? You'd be damn. Like, I know we weren't thinking like collectors as a kid, but as a kid, I'd never do that. You know?
Beautiful piece.
Yeah. It's
really, really beautiful. And again, this is all the little bonus stuff that they did to fill in the extra page counts. And another other thing I love about Kubert is when he's great at drawing very distinctive faces.
Mm-hmm.
Later on in 47, when you have like kind of the piratey guys and they find a note and it says, "This is the house of Tarzan," the killer bee, the faces he gives these guys are really classic. They all have been baked in the sun and they're all scungy looking dudes. Everybody is very distinctive in a Joe Kubert
heavy
story.
Caricature, and I kind of like it because it kind of breaks up the design a little bit to have these guys. And I noticed that upon revisiting this. Like, I forgot how kind of cartoony these guys look, but it works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really very nice. And again, he was also drew women very beautifully. When Jane comes into the story,
mm-hmm.
there's a really nice panel. It's on page 62. Of the comic, and the panel goes from top to the bottom of the page, and there's a narration that says, "In the deepest recesses of the vast jungle, Jane Porter waits for the return of Tarzan," and it's her sitting at the base of a tree, and we see Tarzan in the background, but the foliage that Kubert is drawing is really beautiful, and it reminds me of kind of like a spot illustration that you would see in like a Tarzan novel.
Hogarth is his name.
Bern Hogarth. Yep. And then they've got the very next panel where she's sitting there with Tarzan has brought her food.
Yeah.
And he's got his legs crossed. And he's like a teenage girl because he's so infatuated with Jane. It's really very charming.
Princess phone. Yeah, there's a lot of nice body language there.
Right. And then the very next page, you've got this scene of this pirate being attacked by the savages.
Yeah.
By the tribesmen. And it looks great because they look like they're about to rip him apart. So, I mean, again, he could toggle back and forth between these wonderful character bits and then these, you know, really grim action and stuff. Again, I'm not saying anything anybody doesn't already know, Joe Kubert's one of the best guys ever to do this.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, we're commenting on somebody. Like, it's preaching to a choir, I'm sure.
Yeah, and Joe Kubert? Oh, who ever heard of that guy?
And that's the other thing that's so appealing about Treasury Edition is you really get to look at their line work. Like, you get a better look at their creative process. And it's addictive. It really is. Yeah. And as I get older, I like large print much, much more.
Well, yeah.
My Digest collection is useless to me now, by the
right,
way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I can't read anything in Digest anymore. One of the things that I will note, and this is just from my personal experience, was, I mean, Joe had a very minimalist style in a lot of ways. I mean, he could render a figure very quickly with just a couple of lines.
Mm-hmm.
And when we had him, he actually did bring in some of his pencil pages that had not been inked for various reasons. And these were pages that he was going to ink later himself. So, I mean, he didn't have to fill in the information. He knew what he needed because it was the same guy. You know, he was going to be inking it. He would talk about how if someone else would ink him, he would do a lot more complete pencils because he felt like, you know, he couldn't expect the inker to read his mind.
Right, right.
So, but I mean, the pages that he had of just his own pencils when he was inking, there's nothing there.
Oh, right.
I mean, there's almost literally nothing there. We were like, how the hell? We were so impressed because we were like, how the hell do you get a comic book out of these couple of lines that he's just sort of thrown down on this page? It was unbelievable. So for him, it really came alive in the inking.
Yeah, yeah. But he knew what he was doing, right?
Yep.
It's like never buy a mechanic's car because, you know, they know how to make the quickest and shortest repair. You know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was unreal. And so, yeah, this was a book that I would imagine probably when he was doing these Tarzan comics, the pencil pages looked like nothing. And then once he actually got his ink pen out, then it really came to life. And this adaptation ends in a way, and this is something, and you know, I've only seen a handful of Tarzan movies. So I'm not an expert, but as far as I know, I remember I read the original Tarzan novel, probably 30 years ago for the first time, and I was completely blown away by the ending. I think the original Tarzan novel, where Tarzan makes the decision to pretend he doesn't know what his family background really is to spare Jane, is one of the greatest endings in the history of literature. I was so taken by that ending, and it's so abrupt. It's Tarzan makes this decision, which proves that he is not the savage that everybody thinks he is by making this choice, and only he will know.
Yeah,
only he know that he's the only one knows making it. I remember being blown away by. I thought that is one of the greatest endings I ever read, and this version by DC by Kubert is, as far as I know, the only time that ending has ever been adapted into another medium.
Yeah,
I've never seen a movie that has this ending.
Yeah, because and I haven't either, and they always go somewhere else with it. You know, they always end it with a big jungle fight or, you know, because they need it for a movie. And it's a bit like one of my favorite books is I Am Legend.
Oh, yeah.
And I Am Legend's ending has never been filmed.
Nope.
It's always a brave moment of self-sacrifice and he cures everybody. Whereas, you know, the and I don't want to spoil the ending for anyone who hasn't read it. And I encourage you to read it. But it's a dark ending and it's a great ending.
Yep.
And it's never been filmed. Ever. And it's silly because I think movies should end like that more often. But yeah, this I like that ending as well. And I know we're not talking about the second one, but I had both as a kid together. Right. And the thing that blew my mind on the second one is that it basically starts on a boat and Tarzan is speaking French. And I'm like, he's James Bond. You know, like... He was James Bond before James Bond, you know, he's getting involved in a caper and it's just so interesting to see him do that. This is from what I can tell, one of the most faithful adaptations I've seen.
Yeah, I love that it ends that Kubert chose this ending. And I mean, of course, again, it's Edgar Rice Burroughs had no idea what he had created.
Mm-hmm.
Because this story, you really could never do another Tarzan story and it would work just fine. But this thing was so massively popular that he was like, oh, okay. And I read some subsequent Tarzan novels and you're right. It does become like a James Bond thing.
Yeah, and then of course,
becomes, I guess, yeah.
The other thing that I always loved, and this was more Filmation's fault for me exposing to that, is that he started getting involved in science fiction.
Right.
You know, and I thought that was fantastic. Tarzan crossed over to Mars and things like that. Like, again, these are things that we credit Stan Lee for doing. And Edgar Rice Burroughs had a universe before anybody else that I can think
of. He sure did. Yeah. I mean, that's the DC, when DC did the Tarzan Family comic, they were pitching all the characters. It was like Pellucidar and Korak and Tarzan, everybody all together. It was very exciting. So the book ends with an ad for the Tarzan comic, which makes sense. If you like this, go read, make sure you read
it. Yeah, and I'm wondering if their motivation behind doing the Shazam Treasury and the Tarzan Treasury were these were like big launches for them. And they really wanted to promote the hell out of these new licenses. I'm surprised we didn't see a Shadow Treasury. Because wasn't that the same time?
Yeah, a little bit. Oh, that would have been great. I mean, we know that DC did a Dick Tracy Treasury, which was their attempt to see if there was any life in that. And it flopped. It flopped so heavily that they never did it again. So Dick Tracy just got that one shot, which makes me sad because I think about what a Dick Tracy Batman crossover could have looked like. But, you know, we never got that. But, yeah, you're right. I think this was – they probably paid a decent penny to get this license, so they wanted to really do it up. And so following the story, you've got these bonus features. There's Bob Rozakis brings us a Tarzan, two different Tarzan puzzles, which are always fun. Luckily, my copies have not been ruined by anybody.
Nor have mine. So.
And then there's a Learn to Draw Tarzan two-pager.
Yeah, because that's
Joe Kubert.
Just draw like Joe Kubert, kids.
Just draw like that. I mean, my parents could have saved $30,000 and that saved me to school.
I was actually kind of amused at the like, okay, is that easy? All right, well, here I go. You know, and look what all I need. This was frustrating to me as a kid. Yeah.
Why doesn't mine look like this?
Yeah.
I can't do this. This is terrible.
Why am I not as skilled as a man with 40 years experience?
Yeah, I don't get it. And then there's a Tarzan maze, and then there's an inset in the Bainside back cover. There's a profile of Joe, literally and figuratively, because there's a profile picture of him, and it says Joe Kubert, Lord of the Drawing Board. It talks about him. And then on the back cover is the tabletop diorama, which is actually very handsome. It's Tarzan swinging on a vine. There's an elephant in the background. I never did these, I've said before, because I was just going to ruin my comic, and I never had X-Acto blades. You can't cut these things with scissors, so I left these pretty much intact.
Patience. I never had any patience. There was no way that was happening for me.
No. So mine are all relatively intact. But I mean, it's a great book. I think it's a really solid adventure, and it tells the story, as I mentioned. It features an ending that I really love, and it's beautiful Joe Kubert artwork. So it's a great treasury. But what I really wanted to have you on to talk about, Brian, is because I'm fascinated that, you know, look, Tarzan's never gone away.
No.
Ever. I mean, basically, since he debuted, there's been movies, there's been a radio show, there's been a comic strip. But the 70s, he really seemed to kind of like pop more in the 70s. And I mean, you can obviously speak to that a little bit. I mean, what was the beginning of your Tarzan fandom? Was it Miga? Was it the doll?
You know what? It wasn't. Because although I remember as a kid, I wanted to bring up the Mego doll, which I really think it's supposed to be Joe Kubert's Tarzan. If you look at the drawings of him in the back of the last few pages of Tarzan in Civilized World, I find it looks just like, with the big sideburns, it looks just like Mego kind of just took one of his comics and tried to copy it. I know the outfit's a little different, but I really feel that that's a Joe Kubert-inspired Tarzan figure.
That haircut, definitely, yeah.
My experience with Tarzan is probably like a lot of people's experience with Tarzan, is that my dad watched Tarzan movies. And, you know, I grew up knowing who Tarzan was probably around the same time I learned who Spider-Man, Batman, and Superman were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, like I said, there was no shortage of Tarzan movies. And I remember particularly being interested in the... I can't remember his name right off the top of my head. There was the color Tarzan movies were the most interesting to me. So the stuff that was like in the 50s and 60s, that seemed to be in regular rotation. There was Jock Mahoney, who...
Great name.
Yeah, Jock Mahoney, who was a pretty... Like, the movie I remember is called Tarzan Goes to India, I think. And... the thing that makes me laugh about that is he looks terrible in the movie, and Tarzan looks kind of old and thin.
Okay.
And it turns out that Mahoney was kind of getting old to play Tarzan. I mean, he was like Sally Field's stepfather. So that, you know, and the, the thing was, he was also like, he had dysentery and had lost like 20 pounds while making the
film.
Oh,
no.
So Tarzan really is really skinny in the movie, you know. But then they got a guy by the name of Mike Henry.
Oh, Mike Henry, who was on MASH. He later played Colonel Penobscot on MASH.
Was he Donald Penobscot?
Oh, he was the second. He's the second Donald Penobscot. Okay, there were two different actors.
So Donald Penobscot was dreamy, eh? Like, because Mike Henry's a giant.
He's the second one. He's in the episode, season six episode called MASH Olympics, where we see him again. And of course, he played Junior in the Smokey the Bandit series.
Yeah. And he's also in Soylent Green, and he actually had a pretty good career. I think he's still alive. Okay. Prematurely bury the man. yeah, that's right. He played a Tarzan for about three or four films until I think he actually sued the producers because a monkey attacked him.
Talked about this on an episode of Pod Stallions.
A chimp like slashed him. It ended his career as Tarzan. But he was what they did in the 60s was they kind of put him into like more of a globe-trotting James Bond kind of role. And, you know, his Tarzan's very smart, and he's a man of action kind of thing. And I like those films a lot. My favorite would be Tarzan and the Valley of Gold. I think that's probably one of his best. I think they're all filmed in Mexico. And then immediately after that, the producers of Tarzan created that television series with Ron Eli that lasted a couple of years.
Right.
I don't think I've ever watched the Ron Eli series, but, you know, Eli's seems like a really good choice for Tarzan. He also, of course,
it was Doc Savage.
Doc Savage, yeah. And so I think those movies were my earliest exposure to Tarzan. Then, the Mego figure came out. And, of course, by like 77, that Filmation show was my favorite show on television. That would probably cement my fandom. But there was a lot going on with the character at that time.
Right, but that's what I'm kind of amazed at, is that like that Mego would tap Tarzan to be like that initial, like, I mean, they had lots of other licensed characters they could have gone after.
Oh, yeah, and in fact, I asked, you know, here's the thing. I've spoken to several people at Mego about the whole birth of the world's greatest superhero over the years, and you forget that, like, yeah, Marty Abrams knew who Batman and Robin were because he grew up with Batman and Robin. None of these guys knew who Spider-Man was.
Right.
Their kids did. And that's why they got the Marvel characters. And you know, I'm pretty sure the canon, like, you know, there's certain stories that have in Mego history that have certain, you know, there's two or three different kind of versions of and it's just people's perspective, right? But I think in the case of the Marvel characters, I've never heard a competing story that wasn't Ken Abrams, Marty Abrams' son, saying, "We're Spider-Man for that character." So I asked Neil Cublin about Tarzan, and he said, "Well, that was just me. I liked Tarzan. My dad called me Tarzan and used to read me the books." So there was no, it wasn't that odd anymore to me why they chose Tarzan. It chose Tarzan because Neil Cublin loved Tarzan.
Amazing.
And the figure was a dud, by the way. It did not sell well. It may have been the presentation, because so early on Mego decided to cover the body with a body stocking. It also may have just been that, you know, while Tarzan had a comic book out there, he didn't have any sort of like Saturday morning media there wasn't like every kid knew who Batman and Robin were because every UHF channel on the planet was playing
the Adam West show,
and same with Spider-Man, and same with Superman. You got the George Reeves Superman, you got the Filmation Superman cartoon, you got the Super Friends. Tarzan didn't have any like of that kind of heavy media presence until about 77, when Filmation ran the New Adventures of Tarzan. So, you know, it was probably too soon, you know, to sell that character. Also, I think they kind of. I ran around to stores as a kid looking for the Tarzan doll because I wanted it. And I never saw it because it was very short packed, I guess. Like two per a case or something like that. So it wasn't a big hit for Mego. And I know Mego had planned all sorts of licenses for Tarzan, and they kind of just abandoned it. And he was the first character cut from the world's greatest superheroes.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Edgar Rice Burroughs themselves terminated the contract. And that may have been done because they probably had signed the Filmation deal at that point.
Okay.
To produce a cartoon series. You know, probably takes like a year and a bit to get a cartoon series to air. So I've always felt that they terminated their deal with Mego so they could open themselves up to more licensing opportunities with this new show coming out. And that's exactly what they did, because 2 years later, Mattel released the Tarzan doll.
Oh, they really?
Yeah.
I've never seen that.
Oh, really?
At least I think I have.
It's
wow.
Absolutely gorgeous. I'll shoot you over a picture. What it is basically is they just took Big Jim, or I think Big Jeff, and darkened his hair and put him in a loincloth. So it's not the most, you know, they didn't spend a lot of money on it. But the card art is gorgeous. And what they did is they included a recycled Big Jim Panther or Big Jim Gorilla with it, so Tarzan has someone to fight. And they come on these cards that are just gigantic.
And wow, I don't think I've ever seen these in my life. I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I'm a little surprised to hear you say that the Mego doll was a flop, because didn't Mego do a Bendy, Tarzan Bendy?
Yeah, they did. They did when, like, I think at the time, that's 74. And the Bend and Flex line, like, the World's Greatest Superheroes must have been flying out the door at the time. So the Bend and Flex line came out, and they made every single character that they were producing for the World's Greatest Superheroes in that format for that 1 year.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, they just did everybody.
They did everybody. And when you're collecting World's Greatest Superhero stuff, Tarzan is usually like the cheapest one, like close to the cheapest one, especially in the male hero department. If you want to get a Kresge card, Tarzan's the one you're going to get for $150.
Okay.
If you want to get a Bendy, yeah, he's a $50 carded Bendy all day. If you want a, you know, a window box Tarzan, he's also easy. Like, they're not, he's the not expensive one of almost every line, except when you go over to Mexico, where they made a fist fighting Tarzan, and he's like the most expensive one.
There was a fist fighting Tarzan doll?
Yeah, in Mexico. Yeah, I have one. Lily Letty made it, and it's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, it's one of my absolute favorite toys. And by the way, I should just plug this. I did a video, it's on YouTube, it's called The History of Mego Tarzan, and it's narrated by my podcast partner, Jason Lindsay. We're doing these monthly Mego historical videos on YouTube, so you can see all this stuff on that video.
Oh, we'll link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, yeah.
That sounds awesome.
It was a lot of fun to do, I got to tell you. My fandom of Tarzan comes from like all these different places. And of course, you know, he was just so in the nomenclature. I mean, you would talk to any kid on a playground in the 70s, and I think even today you can do this, where if you ask them about Frankenstein, they'll do that and walk
right,
around.
Right, yeah.
If you ask them about Tarzan, they'll know about the yell and, you know, beating their chest or whatever. Like, it's so in our pop culture. It's in our vocabulary. You know, there's very few characters like that in the world that are so instantly recognizable as Tarzan.
Yeah, I mean, they keep trying. I mean, obviously, a couple of years ago, they just released the Legend of Tarzan movie. Now, I hadn't seen it, but I actually heard pretty good things about it. And the license never goes away. It's like, it's sort of like the Lone Ranger, except the Lone Ranger really never seems to work in a film, different things. But Tarzan, they keep trying to different levels of. I mean, like, and of course, 84 there was Greystoke, which was kind of like the Merchant Ivory version of Tarzan. And then they decided to do. There was one in the 90s with like Casper Van Dien,
he's not a great actor. But it again, it was kind of fun to watch. I enjoyed that film. I think I own it on VHS.
Okay.
Speaking to the Legend of Tarzan, that was a movie that came out and a bunch of people wrote articles about how it's dated and it's time to retire, and they got outraged, you know, like all that stuff. And it did well at the box office and was critically well, like it was a good film. And I mean, it's got Christoph Waltz in it. It's got Margot Robbie.
Sam Jackson.
Jackson. And it. I love that movie. And I know I'm a Tarzan fan. But, you know, I also can be cynical and critical like anyone. And I really enjoyed Alexander Skarsgård's interpretation of the character. I liked a lot of the touches they did. It's an underrated film. It turns out a lot of films I like get this, like, they get kind of trashed or dismissed, and then they're really good. I also really like Guy Ritchie's The Man from U.N.C.L.E. from a few years
ago. Okay.
I think that's a fantastic. So
are you a what is your opinion of the Bo Derek Tarzan?
You know, I've never seen it. I've tried, but, like, I know it's basically a film to show Bo Derek off in.
Yes, it is.
And what's that guy's name that played him, Tarzan?
Miles O'Keefe.
Miles O'Keefe.
Which they called him on Mystery Science Theater, Miles O'Beef.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where I was going with that. Is, you know, I know him mainly from the Ator movies that he made.
There you go, yeah.
Which are fantastic. But, yeah, I know I've never sat through that. But number one reason is that, and I was just actually discussing this yesterday with somebody, I don't really, Bo Derek doesn't do much for me. Like, that isn't my dream gal. So, you know, why would I watch that?
Right.
And it's so universally trashed, too.
It's a terrible movie. Yeah. I've seen it. It's an absolutely terrible movie, yeah. No doubt about it. And I guess that plays into what you were talking about, that this novel, the original novel, is in the public domain, which is how they were able to make it. Because apparently the Edgar Wright Burroughs estate was not happy that they were making essentially like a softcore porn version of the Tarzan story, but they had no way to stop it.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah, the license has some real ups and downs. And, of course, like, you know, Disney got a hold of it in the 90s.
That's my favorite of their animated movies, actually.
No kidding.
Yeah, I love that one. I thought that was really fun.
I seriously don't dislike it. I saw it in the theater because, you know, I was a fan. Yeah, I think it's fine, and it was nice to see so much Tarzan merchandise out there for, you know, years, you know. And I don't know if you recall this, but Jason is fascinated with it, and so am I, is, like, for no real reason, Trendmasters licensed Tarzan in the late 90s.
Okay.
And just released, like, all, like, At the Earth's Core and Tarzan and John Carter of Mars action figures.
Oh, wow. No, like, I haven't seen any
little,
of
them. And there were commercials for these things, like CGI commercials. I think there was a Tarzan television series coming out, but it was a very low-budget affair starring Joe Lara, who was a great Tarzan. But the show, you know, and the show tried to go to Pellucidar and have all these different plots.
Wow.
The show. Oh my God, that's, but they were filming it in South Africa. It was around the time of Hercules, the Legendary Journey.
Sure, well, the syndicated stuff.
Yeah,
right.
So they were trying to get in there. And, you know, there was a Conan show and a Sinbad show and a Zorro show and the Queen of Swords and Tarzan was in there. And I liked the show, but they really should have given it more money. And so it only lasted one season, but it seemed that had the same logo, the Legendary Journeys. And I'm wondering if that was like Trendmasters was licensing off the back of that. I've never completely understood that, but it was great stuff.
Yeah, that does sound really cool. I love all that. I've read a lot of Edgar Rice Burroughs. I really like it.
Yeah.
We've kind of skipped over the Filmation show because, you know, I know you love the Filmation show.
Do. Yeah.
I mean, we're way afield from the Treasury, but I don't really care. I really just wanted to talk Tarzan because I'm sort of fascinated by it. The DC lost the license or gave it up, depending.
Yeah, I'm not
around,
sure.
Around 77, which was when did the Filmation show start?
77.
77. Okay, so and right at that point, Marvel picked it up.
Yeah,
and Marvel being a bunch of spoil sports, started over at number one.
Yeah.
So they didn't pick up the numbering, and that was – but, I mean, and that comic is actually really good because it's drawn by John Buscema.
John Buscema, I love it. I remember getting it, like, in Christmas stockings and buying it on the shelf because I was very Tarzan crazy. Like, by 77, when that show came out, I was really into it. And I can honestly remember – talking like the Robert Ridgely Tarzan as a kid. Like, I remember my dad got me up really early one morning and I was walking around and I said, I feel weak like a cub. And he just, my dad was like, what are you talking about? What?
I love the data point that the guy that played the Colonel in Boogie Nights was also Tarzan of the Apes.
Yeah, that's great. Fantastic. Thanks. Thundar is a chicken hawk. That's awesome.
Oh, my God. Yeah, how long did the Filmation show run? Because I remember watching it, too. And I've never been huge on Tarzan, but I've always liked him. But, I mean, I watched that show, too. I just thought it was a really fun show.
It wouldn't go away. I think a lot of those shows, you know, a lot of Saturday morning shows, when you look at the 70s and stuff, there was, like, they would get one season and then a season of repeats. Mm-hmm. But I think Tarzan was such a big hit for CBS, like it was the Tarzan Batman Hour, that it got like
what better characters to pair than Batman and Tarzan?
I think that's fantastic. They actually kind of did a second season, I believe, and then the show kept going. Like it became Tarzan and the Super Seven. And then I think they were running it up until the early 80s.
Wow.
It did not go away. I remember that. And it was a well-done show, and it was well-received. I think it actually may have actually won some awards. I'm not 100% sure of that. But, yeah, it was one of the more successful endeavors for Filmation.
Yeah, that's like I said, it's a really well done show. I mean, and I think I remember that opening sequence that I pretty sure was like rotoscoped or had Tarzan swing. Like,
oh, yeah.
Tarzan had to be hard to do because you have to really be good at human anatomy. You know, you can't hide behind monster characters or people whose anatomy you can just sort of make up. It has to look like a regular guy.
There's not a lot there's no capes or cheating on that. Yeah, there was a lot of rotoscoping in that. And I mean, like, Filmation did that with every cartoon they did. I mean, even He-Man, there's tons of rotoscoping. But it really lends itself to Tarzan, who is, of course, running and jumping and swimming everywhere.
Right.
You know, you really, I guess you can kind of cheat with the vine swinging for a while. But, yeah, there's not a lot. There's a lot of walking in Tarzan stories. He doesn't have a car.
You mean vine swinging? You could just take the stuff from Spider-Man, the Ralph Baxter Spider-Man, and him swinging and just painted and put a loincloth over the basic cells, and you've got something. Yeah, I mean, I have not read a lot of Tarzan comics of any era, really. But I mean, these treasure. There is a second Tarzan treasury from DC. These are both really handsome comics, and this is the kind of thing where I think these might have been the only Tarzan comics I read, but maybe were because I bought every treasury I could get my hands on. But I mean, they're really nice, and so DC clearly really was into it for a long period of time. It is weird to me that the license ended right as Filmation started, because you think they would do well, but I guess that was Marvel was like, all right, now we have it. But I mean, I think these are some of the nicest Tarzan comics probably ever done. They're really beautiful, and again, the cover to this particular treasury is just gorgeous. And
yeah.
I mean, these treasuries hung on for sale, because I remember having this one as a kid. It came out on newsstands on August 9th of 73, which would have been way too early for me to have bought it off the
exactly.
time. So exactly,
yeah. I remember clearly going, well, there was a place, it's still in my hometown, called The Corner Store. But they used to have one of those giant magazine racks in the late 70s. I remember it was by the door, and all above it was like Major Matt Mason toys and unsold Star Trek kits and, you know, like 60 toys above it. But they would have that wall of treasury editions at the very back behind the comics.
Oh, beautiful.
So, you know, that's my memory of treasury editions, you know, seeing Tarzan, seeing Shazam, seeing, I think there was a horror one, and seeing that Dick Tracy. I remember seeing that Dick Tracy. Like, they burned into my head because they were there for a long time. And I did, you know, whenever I could finagle a treasury edition, I would, you know, finagle it. But, yeah, I would have been 2 years old when it came out. And, you know, I don't think I remember it from being 2 years old. So it must have hung around, like you said. I wanted to just bring up the way I reunited with those treasury editions is kind of comical. I think it was the mid-1990s, the mid to late 1990s, I got relocated to a city called Edmonton, Alberta. I think they filmed Superman 3 there. And I, you know, I didn't know anyone in town, so I would spend my nights going to all the comic book stores and toy shops and that sort of thing, and flea markets. And that town, I swear to God, Edmonton, Alberta, was like Treasury Edition Central. Every comic book store just had a huge pile of them in the corner. And it was, you know, it was in, like, and they were like 10 bucks each. So I shipped at least three different boxes home to myself during my stay there. But I remember I bought like 14 or 15 Treasury Editions.
Nice.
And the two Tarzans were like, oh, these are, you know, these are going home with me. It was awesome. It was just absolutely awesome. And I then, you know, with nothing to do in my evenings, would sit and read Treasury Editions.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Like I really, like this was the, I didn't even have a laptop at the time. So there was no internet for me or, you know, it was all just reading time basically, or watch TV. So.
Oh, that's great, though. I mean, it's hard to find these nowadays because, I mean, every Treasury is 40 years old. I mean, even the youngest ones are 40 years old.
I wanted to ask you this question. I'm sorry if you've done it before. Is there some sort of, like, price guide for Treasury Editions? Because, you know, I go to shows and I see Treasury Editions and I go, I don't have that one. And the guy wants, like, $75 for it. And, it's like, where does that come from?
I guess they're listed. I don't know. Is there still an Overstreet guide? I don't even know if there's even that's even a thing anymore.
You're asking a guy that doesn't, like, my wife has a file. I don't even have a file anymore, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I really get the sense that for the most part, these treasuries are priced how the dealer thinks.
Yeah, okay. I was kind of asking about is like, is there a recognized price or is this just, people being completely, you know, this is old.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I back when I still needed a few to fill holes in my collection, I was at the San Diego Comic Con and a guy had the Welcome Back Cotter Treasury, which last ones that I had. And you know, I looked at it and he had it for $50. I was like, get the hell out of here! I'm not paying $50 for this. What's the matter with you? Come on.
Hey, if you ever do that as an episode, I love those comics.
I used to
buy those unironically.
This will be a perfect dovetail way to end the show, wrap up, because of course there's a connection here, is that the Welcome Back Cotter comic book was written by Mark Evanier.
Oh, okay.
The famous Mark Evanier, because he worked on Welcome Back Cotter, the TV series. He was a writer. He was a staff writer on that show.
Yeah.
So they were like, well, we need a guy to write the comic book, and this guy already knows comic books, so here we go. And Mark Evanier has told the story on his website where he talked about back in the early 70s when they were trying to get the publishers to start giving royalties to the creators. And Carmen Infantino or somebody, maybe not Infantino, I don't mean to besmirch him in case it wasn't him, but it was somebody else. Maybe it was the head of whoever was running – Saul Harrison, whoever was running DC. But they said – The actual excuse they used was, well, we can't possibly start cutting checks to every artist and every creator because of the paperwork. It's just too much paperwork to figure all that out. And Mark Evanier said, Saul, you cut a check to Edgar Rice Burroughs' estate every month for Tarzan.
Yeah.
If you could do it for them, you could do it for Jack Kirby. And Saul Harrison was like, no. Like, he just didn't want to hear that. But he used that as the Edgar Rice Burroughs says, well, what are you talking about? You pay that guy every month. Why can't you pay everybody else?
Yeah.
It was like that was the example he used. I was like, it's perfect. It's like, he's exactly right. You could do it for that guy. You could do it for everybody else.
You know, I like him more and more and more. I read his blog and I've mispronounced his name for 20 years, but I find it really funny. We did a Jack Kirby show not long ago and we discussed him. And he's like Candyman. He started commenting on our post on Pod Stallions. That was, wow. You know, that was.
Yeah, the guy's done everything and knows everybody. He's got his hand in all sorts of things. So, yeah, it's amazing. But, yeah, you're right. It's like, come on. You can write Jack Kirby on the check just as easily as you can write Edgar Rice Burroughs' estate.
Oh, my stars. Yeah, that's really funny and just, you know, obviously an excuse.
Yeah, not to really. Pay people. So then we're going to wrap it up here. Like I said, I think we didn't talk about the Treasury as much, but I really was just wanted to use this as an excuse to talk to Brian about Tarzan because he loves Tarzan. And I'm fascinated by Tarzan as pop culture history. And this is just a great comic. I mean, if any of you listening to this don't have this one or haven't seen it and you're kind of like, Tarzan, I don't know, pick this one up.
I would put this as really a top, solid 10, comic top 10 Treasury.
Yeah, it's really, really handsome, handsome volume. So, awesome. Well, Brian, thank you so much.
Hey,
I always
Rob.
Enjoy talking to you. This is always so much fun. Where can people find you on the internet?
Usually hiding in my basement. but I, of course, have two websites that folks might know. One is MegoMuseum.com. It's dedicated to all things Mego. And, of course, my little treehouse, which is PlaidStallions.com. And we have a monthly podcast with myself and Jason Lindsay where we just talk about pop culture and we never stay on topic.
I can speak to that. That's true. I listen to the show. But it's very fun. It's a really fun show. And you guys just know your stuff. And I just love hearing all this pop culture archaeology. It's just fascinating stuff.
It's so cathartic to get some use out of this. I feel like Mark Hamill at the end of that Amazing Stories where he realizes that, you know, he didn't waste his life. He's rich. Except not, we're not wealthy.
Except you're not wealthy.
Yeah,
but we're just
getting positive feedback for knowing stuff.
And that's why I do this show. And speaking of that, so we're going to pay some podcast promos. And when I come back, we're going to do listener feedback.
I call the light.
I return to destroy you, Ape Cub.
This is Tarzan, the true power of Earth and beyond. At the Earth's core, Tarzan calls the light. To battle the fiendish King Kurtak, his horror, and vile mayhem. Only Tarzan has the power. But will good triumph or will evil?
Tarzan
at the Earth's core with awesome adventure disc.
In 2011, the irredeemable Shag and Aqua Rob Kelly teamed up to create the Fire and Water podcast. In 2016, they teamed up with Ryan Daly, The Franklins, and Siskoid to form the Fire and Water Podcast Network. A network built on teaming up needs a show about team-ups.
Marvel Team-Up?
Yes.
The Brave and the Bold?
You know it.
Marvel 2-in-1?
It's clobbering time.
DC Comics presents?
Of course.
Supervillain Team-Up?
Good idea.
Youngblood X-Force?
Technically.
FW Team Up, coming this summer, only from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
And we're back with listener feedback for episode 28, which was the Ghosts Treasury with Ryan Daly. He's right. It's just fun talking like that. Anyway, we got comments on the website, which is, of course, fireandwaterpodcast.com, from Martin Gray. And he says, that diorama really is rubbish. Cutting out holes with no outside edge is too tough for most kids. Anyway, thanks for a great Halloween treat. Yeah, I agree, Martin. Sometimes these dioramas are just not realistic. Ito Boznar says, geez, just looked at the gallery page. Between the Dark Mansions Digest and the inside back cover image from this treasury, it seems like house pets just can't catch a break this Halloween. You guys did a good job of summarizing the many stories in this book. The sheer amount of stories is a bit surprising. It seems more like something suited to a digest, like the House of Mystery Digest I have, Special Blue Ribbon 24, which also contains 13 stories. And Ryan makes a really good point about there never being a Swamp Thing treasury. It's truly mind-boggling that no one ever thought to reprint some of the initial stories with all that lovely rights and art in the treasury format. By the way, according to the online bios I could find, Leo the Dorfman died in July 1974 at the age of 60, so about 2 months before this treasury hit the newsstands. I can't believe I didn't look that up. That makes me sad. Like, the poor guy didn't even live to see this great collection of his stories. I feel bad. Thank you, Ido, for that information. Chris Franklin from our network says, sounds like a fun collection. I remember seeing this and the House of Mystery treasury among the offerings in that huge ad DC ran in their comics for some time. Being the weenie I was at the time, it scared me, and I wondered why the skeleton guy was always bothering kids. I wonder if Ghost's solid sales figures came from the on-the-nose title. To the casual buyer, the House of Mystery may sound a bit more like detective series, but Ghost just comes out and says, hey, here are a bunch of ghost stories. The true angle may have appealed to the readers of those True West, True Mance type magazines as well, just a guess. I noticed Ryan left out one podcast he hosts on the network. Perhaps the ghost of Nightcast will soon be haunting me? Oh, and I laughed at the Johnny Cash shout out. A couple things, Chris. Yeah, I think that's an interesting observation that House of Mystery doesn't necessarily tell you what you're going to get, but Ghost certainly does. And yeah, maybe they figured it was like these are true life ghost quote unquote true life ghost stories the way these other magazines are. It's an interesting idea. We'll never know, but I think there's something to that. And regarding the Johnny Cash shout out, Chris, you should know that pretty much any shout out I do to Johnny Cash on any of my shows is aimed at you. So thank you. Gothos Mansion says, I really enjoyed the show, guys. I thought this was a fun collection, and like most folks, I found the Opero drawn story to be the highlight of the issue. Agree. Love the early 70s DC horror comics and Treasury, so this was a must-buy for me. As for the all Dorfman writing, he was very prolific back then. I bought a good number of late Silver early Bronze actions recently, and in many of them, Dorfman wrote the first story under his own name and then the backup under the pseudonym Jeff Brown. If you would like some suggestions for next Halloween, I'll have to make them now because I will have forgotten by then. I do the same thing. Anyway, I think Batman Strange's Cases, as I've already mentioned, my all-time favorite comic book ever, or Marvel Treasure Edition number 14 with the first appearance of Morbius would make great Halloween reads. Edo, speaking of Bernie Wrightson, he has a story in Batman Strange's Cases Treasury. Yes, he does. And Wrightson has been in a couple of the Treasuries. He was in the House of Mystery, and there's been a couple others. But yeah, that's a good suggestion, Gothos. That is a great book, Batman Strange's Cases. So maybe that will do that next year. Ryan, put that in your calendar. Luke Jack and Eddie says, I started reading DC horror mystery books in the mid-2000s as part of my general awakening to the depth and width of DC's genre book output. While putting together long runs of these books can be difficult, picking up onesie-twosie issues here and there out of the cheapy bins is easy, and the anthology format is perfect for that kind of collecting. And as such, I have lots of issues of the various DC mystery books from the late 70s and into the 80s. And I have to say, of those, Ghost is usually the least interesting to me. Now, don't get me wrong, the art is usually really strong in the title, and inevitably my anthology book will have varying quality, but the singular focus on ghosts in that series means the stories tend to be a bit more redundant than the other series, which utilize other horrific elements. While I applaud any series which delivers what it promises on the cover, the book is called Ghosts, so help me, Gentleman Jim Craddock, you got Ghosts. It does become a bit one-note. Thanks for the show, and very much looking forward to more. Thank you, Luke, and it's funny you're mentioning Gentleman Jim Craddock, the Gentleman Ghost. I always kind of wondered like why DC didn't do more crossovers. Like they could have had a Gentleman Ghost story in Ghost. I know they were trying to stick to like the true life things, but come on. That would have been really cool. I know Chris Franklin is a big fan of the character, as am I, the Gentleman Ghost. And so I kind of would have been interested in like a solo Gentleman Ghost story or something. That would have been really kind of cool. And to do it in the ghost book would have been really neat. So missed opportunity. Anyway, thank you, Luke. So thanks, everybody, for leaving comments on the website. We haven't had any new iTunes reviews in a while, not since June. So if you could go to iTunes and leave a 5-star review for Treasury Cast on iTunes, that would be greatly appreciated. And I will, of course, read any iTunes reviews here on the listener feedback section of the show. I also find, before we sign off, I do want to thank everybody that retweeted the show on Twitter and helps get the episodes noticed. So big thanks to Griffith Charles, Johnny D. Fetish, Bazinga Cal, Once Upon a Geek, Firestorm Fan, The Mind of Scott X, Dark Longbox, Sean42AZ, Lee Asif, Justice Trek, Factory Mirror, It's Plastic Man, Maxo Romero, Rolled Spine, Dr. Ann 70, Zoom Yukinori, Comics in the Golden Age, and BGSUB Batman. Again, thanks, everybody. Thanks so much for Brian Heiler coming back to the show. I always love talking to Brian, especially about Tarzan, which I know he loves. And those are some really fun comics, the Tarzan comics, especially the DC stuff. So it was great to be able to revisit that. And, of course, there's one more Tarzan treasury to look at if we ever want to get to that. So, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. And until the next episode, go big or go home.